I'm Christopher Lydon with the close reader of poetry, Helen Vendler, this time for Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. Could be about almost anything. In the run-up to the Massachusetts Poetry Festival in mid-October 09, we're trying to locate the bustle of poets today in an American tradition, in a New England tradition, too, as descendants of Emerson and Thoreau and Dickinson, among others, and Wallace Stevens. As the poets keep exclaiming to us, it began with Wallace Stevens, and they always refer to him as sort of inexpressibly beautiful and utterly mysterious. Stevens, the modernist, I think of as the cubist of 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, and so much more, famously an insurance company lawyer in Hartford, Connecticut, a Harvard man, but not an academic. Helen, I always think of you as the poets and the poems and the reader's best friend. We'd love you to decode this magic writer, and maybe especially on the occasion of his selected poems, which you reviewed in the New York Times so beautifully to me. Where should we begin?
Well, we could begin with his being a New Englander. He had a flirtation with Florida and the South and the tropics, and then he eventually came north in a poem called Farewell to Florida, saying, "My North is leafless and lies in a wintry slime." So it was the abdication from the sensual, which he saw as forbidden to him in the future, really, because the marriage was unhappy, and that he was going to be a solitary, and he was going to be living in snowy Connecticut in essentially poetic solitude in a big house where he had an upstairs room that he wrote in at night. And it was a sad life, a stoic life, but and a very reticent life, so that in writing about his own inmost feelings, he usually displaced them onto an abstract level, sometimes cubist and sometimes not. But it's not so much decoding as moving up to the plane on which he lives and living yourself on that plane for a while instead of living on the confessional plane or the plane of the familiar letter or something like that. It's a plane of a symbolic description, but symbolic description that is linked to the tradition of poetry. If he talks about winter, we all know what winter stands for. We all know what autumn stands for, Keats or others. He's very much readable within that tradition.
Connect him to other New Englanders, especially Emerson.
He's more romantic than Emerson, certainly, in that Emerson is, I think of, as essentially an intellectual reformulating philosophical thought for the American context, and along with Thoreau, Dickinson, and others. But I think of Stevens as a poet of the out of doors. He writes a great deal about the look of the landscape, which isn't what Emerson does, except once in a while in the Rhodora or something like that. But then Emerson tends to a more philosophical abstraction rather than a sensuous abstraction. Mm-hmm. And of course, Emerson isn't a very good poet.
Well,
there's that too.
Robert Frost thought he was pretty good. Harold Bloom thinks he's pretty good. But I was just thinking of self-reliance and a kind of Americanism in Emerson and maybe in Stevens, too.
Yes, it's true that in each case, the independence of the American artist is asserted. Stevens never went to Europe, although he could have done. The closest he was to anything foreign was Havana.
Yes.
And he felt his European heritage had propelled him into poetry, so that in his early sequence, The Comedian as the Letter C, comic sequence about his own coming of age as a poet, he represents himself as coming first from Bordeaux and then going to Yucatan and then to Havana and finally coming to South Carolina. And eventually South Carolina and Florida got X'd out too, and he ended up in New England.
So where should we begin? Where would you like to begin? I love your unfolding of the character here, but where do you want to start among the poems?
Well, we can start with the most famous one, Sunday Morning, if you'd like. It's a long poem. We can't talk about all of it, but we can talk about what it represents in his own evolution.
It might be my favorite. Complacencies of the peignoir and all that.
Well, I like to say something about it because I was reading a lot of modern poetry as a girl, but I would keep coming to Complacencies of the Peignoir and saying, how can a peignoir have complacencies? And turning the page. And then the next page would have 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. And that seemed a sort of absurd idea to me at the time because I was into Baudelaire and high romanticism and whatnot, and I was just unavailable for 13 ways. So I went on not paying any attention to Stevens until at the poetry room here at Harvard, a friend asked to listen to the then commercially unavailable record of Stevens. And I put on headphones to be polite and suddenly heard this gorgeous voice reading to the one of Fichte's Music, which I could understand because it's a hymn to the muse. And that was on my wavelength, so I could penetrate that, enter into it. And from then on, I was hooked on Stevens, so much so that a reviewer of my first book, which was my dissertation on Yeats, said, there is a crypto book on Stevens going on in the footnotes to this book on Yeats. And it was true. Everything I wanted to say at the moment was about Stevens. But he has always been the closest to me of all poets. It's as though before I understood him, I understood him. It's some strange transfusion-like ability.
I'm dying to hear you tell us about Sunday Morning.
All right. Well,
woman in a chair with pungent oranges and coffee.
That comes from a painting by Manet in the Metropolitan, where there's a woman in a peignoir. She's wearing a monocle around her neck, and she's standing next to a wooden column on which is perched a bird, a parrot of some sort, and then around the bottom of the column there are orange peels. So it's clearly takes off from that. Of course, he was a great lover of paintings and spent a lot of time in the Metropolitan looking at paintings and in other museums as well. So that the point of the poem starting off with it, as Emily Dickinson also started off, and as Stevens started off in another poem called Plowing on Sunday, is I am not going to go to church. And instead of going to church, she is staying home. She's not getting dressed to go out in public. In Plowing on Sunday, the poet's persona is out doing servile work, quote-unquote, which you weren't supposed to do on a Sunday, but he's plowing North America, he says, and while everybody else is at church. And as you recall, Emily Dickinson says in one of her poems, some keep the Sabbath going to church, I keep it sitting at home with a bobolink for a chorister, and so on. So there's a tradition of staying at home as a rebellion against our theocratic, Puritan, etc. origins. So you begin with that. And although it begins indoors with the woman in her peignoir and her coffee and oranges at breakfast, which she really should be at church, according to the opinion, no doubt, of her neighbors, her parents, and various other people, it doesn't end up indoors. It ends up outside. It ends up in a beautiful panorama of America, which is cribbed, you might say, from Keats's Ode to Autumn. And Keats's Ode to Autumn takes place in a domesticated landscape with people having kitchen gardens and orchards with apples and wheat fields and so on, and birds singing at the end. And Stevens writes it over as an American poem. So at the end he says, deer walk upon our mountains, and the quail whistle about us their spontaneous cries. Sweet berries ripen in the wilderness. So that is taking the whole of the domesticated English agricultural landscape and putting it into the American wilderness, but yet showing that the sweet berries are ripening there and the deer walk upon our mountains and the quail are around us. And that's a great part of Stevens' poetic impulse, is to take the English tradition, European tradition, really, of the seasons and the landscapes and transfer them to the American seasons, the American landscapes, beautiful seasonal poems. So Sunday Morning is one of those poems in the tradition of Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach, which is probably the most famous of these poems. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar. And so when the sea of faith begins to withdraw and ebb, what do you put in its place? There were many solutions to that offered by philosophers, theologians, poets, novelists. The initial mistake, I think, that Stevens, along with others, made was thinking that you could eviscerate the content of Christianity and put in a different content, but keep the same structure, where you would have some sort of divinity, you would have some sort of ritual, you would have some sort of choral participation, only it wouldn't be angels and it wouldn't be inside a Protestant church. Yeats eviscerated the system and made another system of his own on the basis of Blake's saying, I must create my own system, I'll be enslaved by another man's. So Stevens in Sunday Morning says, well, if we didn't go to church, what would we do? And he begins to explore our appetite for eternity through the woman. It's all filtered through the sensibility of the woman. And she says that she can't evade, even though she's staying at home, the pressure of the story of Jesus, especially the story of the death and resurrection of Jesus. And history is like a big ocean that she travels over, a wide water without sound. And she has to think about silent Palestine, dominion of the blood and sepulcher. Well, what will she do with the story she has inherited from Christianity? And then she decides that divinity, very Emersonian moment, divinity must live within herself. Passions of rain, or moods in falling snow, the bough of summer and the winter branch, these are the measures destined for her soul. Then she reviews the history of mythology, starting with Jove, who was a totally inhuman god, coming down to Jesus, that she sees as half human, half divine. And then why can't we have a God that is all human? I mean, that would be the natural declension. And if that could happen, she says, shall our blood fail or shall it come? Shall our blood fail or shall it come to be the blood of paradise? And shall the earth seem all of paradise that we shall know? The sky will be much friendlier then than now, a part of labor and a part of pain, and next in glory to enduring love, not this dividing and indifferent blue, with a god vanished from the heavens, so it's a dividing and indifferent blue. Then she wonders, after she talks of her satisfaction in the natural world, but when the birds are gone and their warm fields return no more, where then is paradise? So she questions whether the natural world can suffice. And she remembers all the beauties and consolations of the natural world and still objects. She says, but in contentment, I still feel the need of some imperishable bliss. And so then heaven and its eternity comes into play. And the most beautiful of all sequences, reflections, comes in section 5, canto 5, where she says, the famous phrase that's always quoted, death is the mother of beauty, where she decides that imperishableness would be awful, more or less. And it's the way Swift thought that imperishableness would be awful and we'd all turn into Struldbrugs if we kept around. So she sees the reward in the procession of desire from generation to generation and says, although she strews the leaves of sure obliteration on our paths, death obliterates us all, nonetheless, she makes the willow shiver in the sun for maidens who are wont to sit and gaze upon the grass relinquished to their feet. So suddenly the girls have been sitting there unconscious of boys, and suddenly they feel a shiver in the willow. So the boys come, the girls get up from just looking at the grass, the maidens taste and stray impassioned in glittering leaves. The leaves are falling, but desire is starting up again. And so as the maidens taste, of course, it's reminiscent of Eve in paradise, tasting the apple. But the boys with their plums and pears and the girls tasting the plums and pears is his justification, Stephen's justification, for being here at all. Towards the end, he decides to think about a new ritual. What would it be like if we had a new ritual, a new religious ritual, and what we were worshiping was the sun instead of Jove or Jesus or anybody else? And he writes the worst piece of the poem, where he imagines an orgy of men worshiping the sun Supple and turbulent, a ring of men shall chant in orgy on a summer morn their boisterous devotion to the sun, not as a god, but as a god might be, naked among them like a savage source. Then he tries to turn it all into Christianity. Their chant shall be a chant of paradise. And in their chant shall enter voice by voice the trees like seraphim. And then it ends quite beautifully after the orgy. The men shall know well the heavenly fellowship of men that perish and of summer morn, and whence they came and whither they shall go, the dew upon their feet shall manifest. The old symbol of the soul as a drop of dew that descends from the heavens has a brief life here on earth and then is reabsorbed into the heavens. And so just as summer morn vanishes, so do our dew-like moments immediately vanish. And then he can end. And he tries to end on a philosophical, he does end, at first, on a philosophical note. How can we rightly describe this life, then, that we are living, which is only the natural life? There he's thinking of Wordsworth, who says that it's on this earth that we find our paradise, or not at all, as Wordsworth says in the Prelude. So if this is our paradise, how can we characterize it? And the first thing Stevens does is have the woman hear the voice of modernity that repudiates the Jesus story. She hears upon that water without sound a voice that cries, "The tomb in Palestine is not the porch of spirits lingering. It is the grave of Jesus where he lay." There are no angels at the tomb saying, "He is risen, he is not here." We have to think of it as a grave. We can't think of it as a place of resurrection. It is the grave of Jesus where he lay. Then he thinks, what is life then here like? His first solution is, we live in an old chaos of the sun. It's all chaotic. Then he thinks, well, that's not quite true. We do have the cyclical alternations of life in nature. And he tries again. We live in an old dependency of day and night. So there's something we can count on, the regularity of nature. But then he thinks about our emotional condition, even if it is day and then night and then day and then night. And he says his next or island solitude, unsponsored. And that's sad. Nobody is taking care of us. But then he thinks again. He says, free. So he's balancing off free against unsponsored. We live in an island solitude of that wide water of history, inescapable. In any case, that's where we are, in the middle of history, unsponsored, in island solitude, but also free. Then the philosophical part ends, and he ends with the imitation of Keats. Deer walk upon our mountains, and the quail whistle about us their spontaneous cries. Sweet berries ripen in the wilderness, and in the isolation of the sky at evening, casual flocks of pigeons make ambiguous undulations as they sink downward to darkness on extended wings. Their wings are extended. They are going down voluntarily, even though they are sinking. They are pigeons and not doves of the Holy Spirit. They have been naturalized into ordinary birds. And they are visible in the isolation of the sky, which goes back to our island solitude, Isola Island, isolation of the sky. And they are casual. They are not foreordained. They're not providential birds coming down like the Holy Spirit. And the undulations that they make, the movements that our emotions essentially make as we sink downward to darkness on extended wings, are ambiguous. You can't say it's unreservedly happy. You can't say it's unreservedly pessimistic as you encounter life, but it is this and it is that, and it is here and it is there, and it is up and it is down. And so, and undulations, for that very reason, is the perfect word, because it's the waves of that wide water, the undulations of history mirrored, you might say, in the undulations of the pigeon's wings. So he ends up as a firm announcer of the immense beauty to be had in the natural and uncultivated wilderness of America, and in the reliance on these cycles of nature as organizing our natural life, and in the fact that meaning is alternately present and absent to us in our lives in those ambiguous undulations. But it's not a hard poem, really. Once you see it in the traditions, the seasonal traditions, the Keatsian tradition, the Wordsworth saying we find happiness here or not at all, and the tradition of the recession of the Sea of Faith, and what do we put in its place? And as you remember, Arnold thought there was nothing to be put in its place, and his images of where we end up, quite unlike Stephen's beautiful ones here, when he says, our love, let us be true to one another, for this world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. That's a very dark ending, of course.
Darker than an old Chaos of the Sun, you mean?
Absolutely, yes.
Helen, I laugh because, all of these things are so pearly clear as you unfold them, but they always escaped me. But how are we supposed to know about the painting, for example, of the woman?
We don't need to know about the painting. I'm just saying it because it is one of his, as I think, one of his sources. He has many sources, as all poets do. Hmm. Keats had the Elgin Marbles. You can't help them noticing things they were born. As Robert Lowell says, we were born to notice. And it's not important. She's an anonymous woman here. Hmm. It's not important that you attach her to anything, except that she is in a certain rather luxurious state with her peignoir and her coffee and her oranges. She's a woman of leisure. She's not a work woman or something like that. But that's all. She's
not to mention the green freedom of the cockatoo upon a rug.
That's right,
that's
yes.
It's a good rug.
Yes.
Keep going. And I'd love you to unfurl your reading of The Snowman, the one-sentence poem that a lot of people know as sort of quintessential Stevens. But then I want you to sort of explain why these phrases, this thinking, the shape of poetry is such a kind of touchstone for writers today.
Well, if I can address the last first, he is a great poet of modernity and of Americanness, whereas Eliot and Pound essentially turned themselves into, or they tried to turn themselves into, European poets, so much so that Pound X'd out the whole part and Eliot dropped the whole American part of The Wasteland, which took place up in Gloucester, where he spent his summers. But as it stands now, it begins in a wholly European way and goes on through European literature, and America doesn't feature in The Wasteland. Mm. It was X'd out, literally, and Pound's occupation was with America in part in the economic criticisms, but and things about the presidents in the cantos. But fundamentally, he was more interested in China and the Renaissance and other things, I think, than in America as such. And he really doesn't mention American literature much. He mentions Yeats and so on. But he's more interested in Homer or European tradition in general. Even Frost had to go to London to be published. Nobody was going to publish him in this country. They felt repudiated by the indifference to poetry that this country has always shown. It was connected with the other arts to an elite tradition and seemed to be the decadent occupation of aristocrats instead of something that practical Americans should engage in. That was true of music, of course, as well. I was told that it took a full vote of the Board of Trustees at Swarthmore in 1879 or something to allow a piano on campus. It was that severe.
It's true of jazz. Duke Ellington was not taken seriously until he went to London in the 30s.
Exactly. You couldn't get an audience for Native American productions, except at the popular level, but not at the reflective level at which Stevens is occupying. Of course, it's true of novelists, too, who went over to Fitzgerald and so on, who went to America. Like Faulkner, Stevens stayed home and thought of it as part of his duty to become a poet of America and not to give up on America and go over to London or Paris or wherever else there was to go, Rapallo. So that I think that's one reason why he seems so attractive to contemporary poets because he took on what they're taking on. You really can't be an Anglophile poet any longer or go and live in Paris and think you can write from there as an American. Mm. Of course it could be done by anybody can go anywhere and do wonderful work. But nonetheless, the impulse here now is to try to create an American art that will be viable on its own terms. And he's really, he and Faulkner are the two big examples of that. Mm. More so than Frost, I think. Frost is always writing Latin. He's always writing hendecasyllabics and things like that. Mm. He's also writing colloquial things. But I think Frost stays closer to Latin in some ways than as conceptions, eclogues. Frost is always writing eclogues. Mm. Whereas Stevens is thinking up new forms. But he's also writing really obstreperous American poems at the same time, like Bantam's In Pine Woods, where he's being a little bantam rooster standing up to a great big rooster who is presumably the European tradition, mm. with like an Inca chief with a big feather cape. And the poor little bantam says to the big rooster, "Fat, fat, fat, fat. I am the personal." And the big universal person has to cede finally to the personal in that, and it happens in the pine woods of America, beating back the big, impressive rooster. So that Stevens is the bantam standing up for his own terrain and his own right to be lyric rather than philosophical.
Hmm. Read for us The Snowman and tell us what you will about what that's saying, what that's doing.
Well, that's coming from another poem, too, a very famous poem by Keats, where Keats says, "In drear nighted December," he begins the poem, "too happy, happy tree, thy branches ne'er remember their green felicity." And so the natural world, when it comes to be winter, doesn't fret about the frozen time, as Keats says. It goes with the seasons with complete equanimity as they come and go. We, however, when we lose the green season, regret it, have nostalgia for it, tend to rest in our nostalgia rather than look around us and see what there is to be rejoicing in now. As Eliot said, having to construct something upon which to rejoice. Sometimes we're not even willing to do that. So this is a poem about trying to resist the aching nostalgia of the loss of deciduous vegetation and green grass. And looking around him, he sees what there is to be seen, but he's damned if he'll enjoy it. And so, although he tells us how beautiful the landscape around him is, he's not prepared to join in with it. He's still regretting the past. He would like to have a mind of winter, but unfortunately he still has a mind of summer, but he's trying to get rid of it, to have a mind of winter and to live in the moment, as we would say, rather than living in the past. One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and have been cold a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land, full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place for the listener, who listens in the snow, and nothing himself, beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. Well, that by the end he's come round to looking where he is, trying not to see what isn't there, the green, the leaves, the misery and the cry of the wind, and the looking around and saying, isn't it bare? It's not at all bare there. It's full of the juniper shag with ice, and the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun. Glitter, sun, you have everything you could want to rejoice in, but he doesn't want to rejoice in just that because he wants the leaves, and the leaves now have fallen. There's a few of them around him on the ground. And so it's a great fight against nostalgia and the emptying out of the self. In The Snowman, the speaker, of course, it is spoken in an impersonal way. It's not I, it is one must have a mind of winter to look at these this winter scene, frost and junipers and ice and all the rest, and not to think of any misery. He begins as a beholder to regard, to behold. He ends up as a listener. He tunes the other sense in to listen to the misery of the wind, the lament of the wind, that again he's not supposed to listen to. And he says, "You mean I could never see green again? You mean I have to listen to nothing but this wind?" And finally he turns into a listener who listens in the snow. And then he does the complete evisceration of self, which is required for the step into the present and away from nostalgia. So he has to become nothing himself. He can't be the person he was any longer. He's going to be a new person, and he must behold. He goes back to being a beholder. He must behold nothing that is not there. He can't behold green trees. He can't behold green grass. He can't allow himself to behold what is not there. And then he must contemplate, he must look at the nothing that is. And he has to define it as the nothing right now. He can't define it as the something, even though he's shown us all that wonderful something of the glitter of the January sun and the juniper shagged with ice. There's lots of somethings there. But for him, at the moment, it is a nothing that he has to take in.
Surely he's playing with an idea of nihilism. Nothing.
I have been reproached for saying that this is about his marriage, but it seems to me it is about his marriage. There's got nothing left there. There's nothing there to hold on to any longer. There's no satisfaction. There's no joy. There is nothing but to look at the nothing that is there and not to look back, just to look at what is and admit what is and eviscerate yourself of your own past and say, all right, it's a new life. I have to live this life, not the life I thought I was going to go on living. And the nothing seems to me the absence of eros. When you have pitched your life on Eros, as he had, and discovered he was conspicuously mistaken in his choice, then it was like a desert. And that's the nothing that is. It's the wasteland in him is the absence of Eros. So he had had all of the promise of falling in love and all those early poems to Elsie, and the rapturousness of his little June book to Elsie, and then it had congealed into this very bad marriage. So this is a poem of a hopelessness for a past that won't return, but it's also what the French would call a constatation, recognition of what the new state of life that he's going to have to live will be. And certainly by 43, or even before that, he knew what that was.
What do you mean that people have beaten you up for saying it's about his marriage?
They think it's a larger poem than that. They want to see it more philosophically and less romantically, I suppose. I just can't imagine what could erase your entire past that you had built your life on and compelled you to eviscerate yourself and to start something, a stoic recognition of cold and misery. And it's testified to by so many other poems. There's a poem, I think of maybe one of the late poems, maybe the last poem in the collected poems, which is such a beautiful poem. It's sort of the opposite of the snowman. And it's the poem of a very old man who doesn't think he'll live to see another spring. He thinks he'll die in the winter. And it's like Hausmann, since to look at things in bloom, 50 springs a little room. About the woodland I will go to see the cherry hung with snow. And that's a young man saying, you know, I don't have enough time to see all the springs that will be coming, even if I live for 50 more years. So you can imagine when you're at the end of your life and think you'll never see spring again, which was always a resuscitative time for Stevens. He often didn't write in the low winter, and then he began again in the spring. And he wakes up early, and he hears the cry of a bird. And he thinks, it's spring. I've lived to see it. And then he thinks, oh, no, it was part of my dream. I was making it up. And then he thinks, well, was it real or was it not real? And then he tries to confirm maybe another sign of spring. And he looks out and he says, sun is coming up at 6, earlier than when it came up in the winter. So it is spring. And the sun is no longer this tired, old sun. It's a new sun full of panache, and no longer a battered panache, but an unbattered one. And he's so glad that it wasn't a dream, that it didn't come from sleep's faded papier-mâché made up. And then he decides that that single note of the bird is like the pitch pipe that is played to give the choir the signal to start in. And so now he knows the great choir is coming, and now that the sun is coming up earlier, he knows that the colossal sun is coming. And so he breathes this huge sigh of joy that he has lived to see the spring. He calls it not ideas about the thing, but the thing itself. He has once again come to see the Ding An Sich, the real reality of the new year. He writes many poems about the cusp of the seasons, when one season is turning into another. He loves that indefiniteness. And so he doesn't call it the beginning of spring. He calls it the earliest ending of winter. He isn't yet ready to call it spring. At the earliest ending of winter in March, a scrawny cry from outside seemed like a sound in his mind. He knew that he heard it, a bird's cry at daylight, or before, in the early March wind. The sun was rising at 6, no longer a battered panache above snow. It would have been outside. It was not from the vast ventriloquism of sleep's faded papier-mâché. The sun was coming from outside. That scrawny cry, it was a chorister whose sea preceded the choir. It was part of the colossal sun surrounded by its choral rings still far away. It was like a new knowledge of reality. I think that's a wonderful poem of old age. It's so simple. Again, there's a single bird cry and there's a nascent sun, and that's all. But on that tiny, fragile base, he builds the whole of the choir, the colossal sun surrounded by its choral wings. The intimation of the whole lies in the first perceptions of the old man.
What's the huge difference between that and the darkling thrush, say?
Yes.
Almost the complete opposite.
No, it's in the same tradition as the darkling thrush, some blessed hope of which he knew and I was unaware until I heard him. But, I mean, it's as though Hardy is so struck by the blessed hope of the darkling thrush that although he says he was unaware of any grounds for hope until he hears the bird, nonetheless, he feels heartened by hearing the bird at the turn of the century when the century's all dying and dead.
Laid out like a corpse, yep.
Yes.
Although this has a certain real hope about it, and Hardy almost not.
Almost not, no. Stevens was always exhilarated by the spring, even in its most tenuous form, and always grieved by the fall, which seems to make life unintelligible.
You know, I mentioned this cubist notion of Stevens, and I'm glad you didn't shoot me down in for complete insanity, but you also compare him in a certain way to, or analogize him to, Paul Klee, which struck me as brilliant.
Loved Paul Klee. It was his own idea.
Oh, he did, really?
Yes, he was his favorite painter.
Make that connection.
Well, it's whimsical. I think that the playful side of Klee is encouraging to the playful side of Stevens, because poetry has, on the whole, been quite solemn. Serious poetry has been quite solemn, and then you have limericks and Gilbert and Sullivan and so forth on the other side. But to find a way to be serious while being whimsical is something that he sees in Klee and recognizes in himself. I don't know more than that, but I think it is the lightheartedness of Klee as opposed, I suppose you could say, to the gloom of some of Picasso. I mean, it's joyous Picasso, too, but when you think of the absinthe drinkers and things like that, Klee is great counterforce to that.
Helen, would you take one more familiar poem, glittering, wonderful, but to me, deeply mysterious poem, short one, but the kind of thing people love about Stevens, that disillusionment of 10 o'clock.
Oh, yes. It's a very American poem, too. It's about hating the suburbs. When I was living in a suburb, everybody put their lights out at 9:30, and I was the only person in the three streets visible who still had an evening light on. And I thought, why do they all want to go to sleep at 9:30? I mean, I had a child, too. It wasn't just because they had children. They somehow retreated from life very, very early, much earlier than I wanted to think about retreating from life in a given day. So here's poor Stevens awake at night, like me, disillusionment of 10 o'clock. The houses are haunted by white nightgowns. None are green, or purple with green rings, or green with yellow rings, or yellow with blue rings. None of them are strange with socks of lace and beaded centaurs. People are not going to dream of baboons and periwinkles. Only here and there, an old sailor, drunk and asleep in his boots, catches tigers in red weather. And the old sailor, of course, has seen the world, but America is desperately provincial, especially the American suburbs. And we have no borders, which makes us terribly provincial. We don't often see foreign cultures, at least in Stevens' day, where if you lived in Hartford, Connecticut, you never saw anybody that wasn't like you, more or less. He knows the enormous possibility of your garments in life. And why are they all wearing the same thing? Plentiful little mannequins, as Whitman calls them, skipping about in the streets. Or scantlings, as Whitman also calls them. Why should a great country like America produce scantlings like these little mannequins? But he has realized that America isn't going to change, at least not in his lifetime. People are not, the hippies hadn't arrived. Woodstock would have people with nightgowns with green and orange and purple and all the rest, but that kind of particular liberation of dress hadn't appeared, nor had the wish to see exotica, which has now been fed a great deal by television. People want to think about baboons and periwinkles, but it was not so then, and he felt, of course, hemmed in and constricted with his own elaborate imagination in the middle of all these people all wearing their white nightgowns. So depressing. They didn't have any sense of the past. They weren't going to have socks of lace, those nice old things people wore, maybe in 18th century nightgowns and beaded belts on their nightgowns. And none of that. It was Puritan. Nobody had decorated dresses. Nobody imitated antique fashions. Nobody dreamed of exotic places. And he feels really disillusioned by his own country in its provinciality, its Puritanism, and its unavailability to the imagination.
The barrenness, Emerson said.
Yes, and James said it too. We have no past, essentially. How is the novelist, he said, writing about Hawthorne, how is the novelist supposed to write when he has nothing to build on in the way of a cultural past?
Helen Vendler, this is a huge treat. I feel like the embodiment of generations of people who have learned poetry from you, and especially Stevens. I mean, you are a touchstone for me now of what it means to be, for so many poets we talk to be connected to this man.
Well, of course, he's delightful in every line.
That helps.
Who would not be attracted? As they say, he's very beautiful, quite aside from whether you have yet penetrated the poem. As I think Coleridge said, poetry can communicate before it is perfectly understood. And a lot of people find that communication coming off these pages.
Helen, you help a huge amount. Helen Vendler, thank you enormously for this conversation.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Professor Helen Vendler about her first and closest poet, Wallace Stevens. Our Brown University interns Hannah Olson and Ben Mandelkern have been up to their necks with us in American poetry old and new. You can link to all the Stevens poems that Helen Vendler mentions on our website, radioopensource.org. And while you're there, leave a comment with your own take on Wallace Stevens or your alternative inspirations in poetry. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of this conversation.